So last Sunday evening, after quite a long time away from Proverbs, we resumed in this book, and we're there then this evening in the passage that I read earlier on, chapter 14, and verses 8 to 14. And really then, I think the key phrase in this passage is the one we find in the second half of verse 8 there. The folly of fools is deceiving. The folly of fools is deceiving. Remember, in verses 1 to 7, Solomon has been talking about the dangers of what we called last week sexual tempters, those who seek to draw you into sexual sin. And remember then, we came up last week with five bewares from those first seven verses. But really, I guess all those five bewares could really be summed up in a single sentence, which is this: beware their deceptiveness. Beware the deceptiveness of those who try to tempt you sexually. Whether it's the deceptiveness of their piety, remember we talked about that, them playing the religious card, oh, I'm fearing the Lord, which then disarms you and makes you think that it can't be so bad after all what they're suggesting. Or whether it's the deceptiveness of their words, the flattery that they direct at you. Really, everything that we saw in those seven verses could be summed up in this way: when it comes to sexual tempters, beware their deceptiveness. And here now, in this next section now, Solomon is in many ways continuing in the same vein, but he's now broadening the focus. So it's not the deceptiveness of sexual tempters specifically that he's considering, but rather the deceptiveness of those generally who reject God. Fools, as he describes them there in the second half of verse 8. He's saying to us then that the godless lifestyle can look attractive. It can be alluring. It can pull the wool over our eyes. The folly of fools is deceiving, he says. And in verses 9 to 14 then, he kind of breaks that down into three particular areas from which I think we can infer this evening three exhortations or three warnings. Three exhortations or warnings that we can arm ourselves with tonight. You see, we are surrounded, aren't we, all of us, by people whose lifestyles are non-Christian. People whose lifestyles are not shaped by biblical revelation, by the truths of the gospel, by the lordship of Jesus Christ. Foolish lifestyles in Proverbs terms. And yet, if we are honest, don't we have to admit that sometimes those lifestyles fascinate us? And sometimes they can make quite an impression on us. And so it will be good then, I think, for us this evening to arm ourselves with these warnings, these exhortations that Solomon implies in these verses, and hopefully they will make us less vulnerable to this deceptiveness of the ungodly lifestyle that Solomon is talking about. So exhortation number one then: don't mistake their arrogance for assurance. Don't mistake their arrogance for assurance. And this is verses 9 and 10. So notice then in verse 9, Solomon mentions the guilt offering. And if you're a Bible reader then, that terminology won't be strange to you. The guilt offering, of course, was one of the sacrifices prescribed by the law of Moses. You can read about it in passages like Leviticus 5 and 7 and 14. And the guilt offering then in the law of Moses, it involved either a ram or a lamb normally. And the offering in many ways is self-explanatory. Its meaning is there in the name. It was an offering to God for your guilt. In a situation then where you had broken God's law and offended God. And It's in that connection then that we have that phrase in the next line of verse 9, the upright enjoy acceptance. Now Solomon is talking there about acceptance with God. And I suppose if we just have that phrase by itself, the upright enjoy acceptance, we might think it means then that the upright enjoy acceptance with God on the basis of their uprightness, on the basis of their goodness, their moral righteousness. But no, this word acceptance, again, is a common word in the book of Leviticus, connected to sacrifices. So if you had sinned then and offended God and you offered a sacrifice in the correct way, then God would cease to be offended and you would be accepted. That word accepted is often used in that way in the book of Leviticus. And that then is what this is talking about in verse 9. The upright enjoy acceptance with God despite, in fact, sometimes not being upright, despite sometimes breaking his law, but on the basis of the guilt offering, they enjoy acceptance with God. But notice something else then in verse 9. Notice that there are others mentioned who also break God's law then, but they don't seek acceptance with God through the guilt offering. And you'd have thought then, these people, these Israelites, that's probably who Solomon has in mind, people who are part of the Israelite community, you'd have thought then these people would be quivering wretches, terrified of this God because they've offended him and that offense hasn't been dealt with and God hasn't been appeased through sacrifice. But Solomon says in that verse, no, that these people, they aren't quivering wretches. They mock the guilt offering. That's what he says in verse 9. These people he's talking about here, they laugh at the idea of blood being shed to atone for what they've done. Far from being deeply exercised and anxious and conscience-stricken, they are defiant and self-confident and arrogant. Now, at this point, let's just stand back for a moment. This concept, then, of the guilt offering, as I say, it features prominently in the book of Leviticus and also in one or two other places in the Old Testament. But, you know, it reaches its climax somewhere else. This Old Testament concept reaches its climax in the prophecy of Isaiah. A verse you'll be familiar with, perhaps, Isaiah 53, verse 10. And there then, we have the same Hebrew word, guilt offering, and we have described in that verse a guilt offering being carried out. But this is a different kind of guilt offering altogether than any prescribed in the law of Moses, because the sacrificial victim here isn't a ram. And it isn't a lamb. And it isn't, in fact, an animal at all. It's a person. And the one conducting this sacrifice is not an Israelite priest dressed in his robes. It's God himself. He's the agent highlighted in the verse. What on earth is that talking about? Well, of course, you know Isaiah 53. It's a prophecy of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, because you see, that event was also a guilt offering. In fact, it was the one true guilt offering to which all of those prescribed by the law of Moses and carried out over so many centuries had been pointing all along. They were illustratory previews of this guilt offering. The crucifixion of Jesus Christ was the real thing, the real guilt offering. And we this evening then, if we are Christians, we know, don't we? We've all broken God's law and offended God by our behavior. But through then the guilt offering of Calvary that we are trusting in, that we are leaning upon, God has ceased to be offended. And in the language of verse 9, then we enjoy acceptance. On the basis of the guilt offering of Golgotha, we enjoy acceptance with God. That's the trajectory, that's where the lines of Proverbs 14:9 take us. They take us to us tonight as those enjoying acceptance with God through the great guilt offering. But the other language of verse 9 about fools mocking at the guilt offering, that also applies in our situation, doesn't it? Because, of course, we are surrounded by people who have also broken God's law and have also offended God, but they're not seeking acceptance with God on the basis of Calvary's guilt offering. And you would have thought then that they would be terrified. Can't they see that there's this God and they've offended him and their sins are unatoned for? You'd have thought they would be cowering and quivering and terrified, but no. As this verse says, they mock. They mock, they laugh at the whole idea of blood being shed by Jesus Christ to atone for their sins and reconcile them to God. It's nonsense to them. Far from being deeply exercised and anxious and conscience-stricken, they're defiant, they're self-confident, they're arrogant in their rejection of the guilt offering of Jesus Christ at Calvary. And I think that arrogance then can take us aback sometimes. It can sometimes perhaps cause us to start reevaluating things. We can start to think, well, if their consciences are so untroubled by unatoned sins, then is unatoned sin really this great problem that I've always considered it to be? Or am I perhaps just part of this evangelical subculture that's detached from reality and we've invented this non-existent problem and become obsessed with it? The problem of sin and guilt and needing to be atoned. If these people who have no time for the cross of Calvary can yet be so proud and so mocking, so self-confident, so arrogant, then perhaps I've got it wrong. Well, Solomon's answer to that, you see, is do not be deceived. Don't be deceived. Don't mistake their arrogance for assurance. Look what he says in verse 10. He says there, the heart knows its own bitterness. Now, at one level, that's just a general principle. In a way, it's what Tony was talking about on Wednesday evening at the start of his Bible study, that none of us knows what anybody else is thinking, and we don't know what's in others' hearts then. At one level, it's just a general principle, but in the context, it's referring specifically, I think, to these fools then, spoken of in verse 9, who are so arrogant and who mock the idea of needing the blood of Jesus Christ, the blood of the guilt offering, to atone for their sins. And Solomon is saying then, yes, outwardly, those people might be untroubled by unatoned sin. But he's saying, you don't know the bitterness. That's the word he uses, the bitterness that it's causing them in their hearts. You're not privy to those moments when they receive bad news at the doctor's surgery, or they're at the funeral of a friend or family member and they're staring at that cold wooden box at the front of the church building. And they're brought face to face with the reality of mortality and death. And their minds go immediately to those episodes in their lives, perhaps in the distant past, of which they are most ashamed. And they're scared in those moments. You're not privy to those. The unrest in their consciences that keeps them awake sometimes at night and causes them to toss and turn on their beds, that's hidden from you. Just as, Solomon says in the next line of verse 10, just as the joy in your hearts, because you do know that you're forgiven through the blood of the guilt offering, Jesus Christ, is hidden from others as well. Others don't see how your heart skipped and danced this morning as the the bread and the wine hit your taste buds, and it came home to you anew that you are forgiven. There's no condemnation. Everything's been wiped out. And there's not so much as a cloud marring the relationship between this blood-appeased God and you, his beloved child. Others didn't see that. Others don't see the wonderful assurance within you that even at the end of a day, which morally speaking hasn't been a great day, enables you to lie down and sleep peacefully, knowing your peace with God to be utterly unbroken. Others don't see that. In both cases, then, the joy of the believer as he revels in his forgiveness and the bitterness of the unbeliever as he worries about future judgment, both of those things are in the hidden arena of the heart. That's what Solomon's saying. And so don't be deceived. Fools may mock outwardly at the guilt offering. In our terms, at the cross of Jesus Christ. They may laugh at it. They may say, oh, I don't need that. Doesn't mean that beneath the surface, they're really unconcerned about their sin and the consequences that might lie ahead of them for their sin. Don't mistake their arrogance, Solomon is saying, for assurance. Don't be deceived. So that's the first exhortation. But then the second exhortation, don't mistake their affluence for attainment. Don't mistake their affluence for attainment. And this is verses 11 and 12 then. Now I guess that Proverbs is a book that health and wealth preachers probably go to fairly often, because there are texts, aren't there, in Proverbs, quite a number of them, which indicate that the righteous will prosper materially. Of course, the point of those texts is that the righteous, because they live their lives before God, they will work hard. They will not be lazy. That's one of the bees that Solomon has in his bonnet, isn't it? Laziness, it's something he attacks again and again in this book. But those then who are righteous, who are God's, they'll not be lazy. They'll work hard, and that often then will reap its rewards in terms of material benefits, material gain. But what you won't hear then from the health and wealth preachers is that Proverbs balances that emphasis with other rather different emphases. And you probably won't hear a health and wealth preacher then ever citing chapter 14, verse 11. Because chapter 14, verse 11 here is saying that the wicked will often be more materially prosperous, actually, than the righteous. Okay, some of the wicked will be lazy, and so they won't be more materially prosperous than the righteous, but some of the wicked will make wealth their god, and they will live and breathe to become rich, and they will go to almost any lengths in order to become rich, and they often will become rich. And so it is then that this verse describes the wicked living in houses and the upright living in tents. This is clearly pointing then to the wicked being more materially prosperous than the righteous. And perhaps this verse resonates with you this evening. Perhaps compared to the luxurious residences of your former schoolmates, your university peers from years ago, who made earning and possessions their number one goal in life, and they threw everything at it, and they made everything else subordinate to that aim. Perhaps compared to their luxurious residences, your pokey little flat, your humble little bungalow seems like a tent. Okay, you don't literally live under canvas, but compared to their places of residence, your humble abode seems like a tent. And in those circumstances, it's tempting to think, isn't it? Well, those people have made it. Well, I've been left behind, while I've fallen short, while I've been a bit of a loser, those people have made it. They've attained the ideal that's held out in all the adverts and in all the lifestyle magazines. They're living the dream. They've made it. I haven't. It's tempting to think like that. That's how the society around us tries to squeeze us into thinking. But Solomon is saying in these two verses, don't be deceived. Don't be deceived. Don't mistake their affluence for attainment. He's saying, what have they really attained? Okay, yes, they might have some impressive bricks and mortar with reception rooms and drawing rooms and en-suites and balconies and hot tubs and landscaped gardens and electric gates and all the rest of it. They might have all of that. They might have attained all that stuff for a while. For a few years, a few decades, perhaps. As they rush headlong toward that great day when they will stand before the holy God who made them, and they will be judged and they will be condemned, in the language of verse 12, to death. The end, its end is the way to death. And that's not talking about mere physical expiry. In Proverbs, death so often means more than just that. It's talking about everlasting punishment in hell. And as then they are condemned to that, the fancy house that they prized will become just a distant, forgotten irrelevancy. In the language of verse 11, the house of the wicked will be destroyed. That's their ultimate attainment, Solomon is saying. Oh, that way that consists of chasing after affluence, that way seems so right to a man, verse 12. It seems so obvious, it seems such a no-brainer, nobody questions it. But its end, he says, is the way to death, eternal death. That's their ultimate attainment, Solomon's saying. Is that really something to be envied? No, he says. You upright, living in your tent, you're in the really enviable situation. You are the ones who are going to attain something that's really worth attaining. Yes, you might be in tents now, but those tents, verse 11, are going to flourish. The Hebrew word is literally bud. And of course, bud means to develop into something else. According to my dictionary, budding is when the compact knob-like growth on a plant develops into a leaf, flower, or shoot. And Solomon is saying then, these little houses that you upright, you believers live in now, they are going to develop into unimaginable dwellings that you will live in that new world that will be unveiled when Jesus Christ returns. So take the long view, Solomon is saying. Take the long view. Perhaps you need to hear that this evening. Don't get into a stew about lacking this and not having that and needing the next thing. So what if compared to some you don't have much? So what if your house is small, your car battered, your budget tight? You're on your way to a world of inexhaustible riches. You're not here long. You can put up with those conditions for a few short years. You know, we're told in Hebrews 11 there, I read from it earlier on, mentioned this at Jamie and Rachel's wedding the other day, they'll have heard this before, but we're told there, aren't we, of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, how they lived literally in tents. They lived literally in tents. And you might think, well, that's because this was a long time ago and houses hadn't been invented then. Houses had been invented then. Abraham's nephew Bethuel, it's clear in Genesis 24, lived in a house. And you might think, well, surely it was awfully unpleasant then. It must have been awfully unpleasant for Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, when others in the ancient Near East, others in their own clan, their own relatives, others were living in houses. It must have been pretty unpleasant for them to be living in tents. Didn't they resent that situation? Well, remember what the writer says. He says in verses 9 and 10 of that chapter, he says that they lived in tents. Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. You see, if you're looking forward to the city that has foundations, if you're looking forward to the world to come, if you're looking forward to attaining that, then you can cope with attaining very little in terms of bricks and mortar and possessions in this life. Let that biblical logic get hold of you tonight. The logic that so impelled Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. We don't need more than a tent, because this is not our final place. We're sojourners. We're traveling to a city, to a world to come. That's where home is. That's where we'll be in the haves rather than the have-nots. And we can be in the have-nots rather than in the haves here, therefore. That's the logic. So don't mistake their affluence for attainment, Solomon is saying. But then we must move thirdly to the final exhortation, which is this: don't mistake their analysis for answers. Don't mistake their analysis for answers. And this is verses 13 and 14. Look at verse 13 then. Even in laughter the heart may ache, and the end of joy may be grief. That is a powerfully somber analysis, isn't it, of life in this world. It's basically saying life in this world is sad. It's not the case that it's about laughter and joy and they are punctuated with heartache and grief. It's the other way around. Heartache and grief, they're the norm, and they're punctuated with laughter and joy. That's what verse 13 is saying. And it's a blanket statement. It's indiscriminate. This isn't just the situation for some people, for the wicked, for bad people. No, this is just the human condition. This is what life is like. This is the world we live in. That's what verse 13 is saying. And of course, it's an analysis that we find elsewhere in the Bible, isn't it? You go back to where it's first established in Genesis 3. All that talk of thorns and thistles and the sweat of your brow and returning to the dust and so on. It's bleak. You go to Ecclesiastes and you encounter it so much there. You go to Romans 8, the creation being subjected to frustration, to futility, to vanity. That's the kind of world this is, those texts are all saying. But of course, it's not just in the Bible that you find this analysis of our world. You find it in much literature from across the ages. And actually, in fact, sometimes the best analyses of the brokenness of this world have come from non-Christian sources, from whether it's the epic tragedies of William Shakespeare or the bitter protest songs of Bob Dylan, whatever it might be. Some of the most brilliant exposures of the brokenness of our world have come from those sources. And of course, we should recognize then the gifts that God has given to those people who have so brilliantly analyzed the world we live in, and we should appreciate the brilliance of their analysis. And I guess it's not just at the level of art, is it? Even in just in normal personal relationships, you meet non-Christians who just do have a very realistic and sober-minded understanding of the brokenness of this world, who don't see life as just one string of parties and frivolity and messing around, but who recognize that life is tough and broken and there's something deeply out of joint about it all. There are many who are able to analyze the world in that way. And we should appreciate that then, wherever we find it. But at the same time, we must beware of being sucked in to that analysis of the world in which we live, as though it's the final word, as though that's all there is to say. This world is dystopian. It's mucked up. It's in a mess. It's out of joint. There's something wrong with its very machinery. We must beware of, when we've been bombarded with that, we must beware of being sucked into thinking that that's all there is to say. No, don't be deceived, Solomon says here in our passage. Don't mistake their analysis for answers, because the Bible goes further than that. Yes, it too analyzes the world as a broken world, a world of curse and toil and frustration. But it goes further. It sets that in a broader context. And Solomon does here, because look at how he continues in verse 14. He says, the backslider in heart, or just the rebel, perhaps a better translation there, the rebel will be filled with the fruit of his ways, and a good man will be filled with the fruit of his ways. So this business of everyone just suffering indiscriminately because the world is such a mess, that's only one chapter of the story. That's only the now. That's only the present. That's not the final word. No, there is a day coming, Solomon says, when the bad will be rewarded for their bad deeds and the good will be rewarded for their good deeds. And justice will triumph. And the final notes will be the notes of justice and retribution and equity. That's what Solomon is saying. So don't mistake the sometimes brilliant analysis of non-Christians for answers. No, there's no answers simply in exposing the messed upness of the world. But in the Bible, we find this bigger picture that shows us the end of the story. And so then, these are Solomon's three exhortations for us this evening. And we need to take them to heart then as believers, because as I said at the outset, the lifestyles, the outlooks of unbelievers around us, sometimes they can be alluring. We can find ourselves being drawn in, and we need to recognize then this deceptiveness and to arm ourselves with these three warnings that we've considered. But I just want to close addressing anyone here tonight who perhaps isn't a believer. And for you then, it's not a case of don't be deceived. It's for you, it's a case of come to Jesus Christ and receive from him assurance that your sins have been forgiven because you're resting on his sacrifice on a cross 2,000 years ago. Come to Jesus Christ and know real attainments, that you are heading for a new world where you will be rich and where you will have everything and you will be with the best person of all, Jesus Christ himself. Come to Jesus Christ and know the answers to this world which seems so confusing as we look out upon it. And know that there is a story that is unfolding. And the present chapter is one of much messiness, but it's all going to culminate in justice and equity and a new world being ushered in. Come to Jesus Christ. Don't settle for arrogance and for affluence and for mere analysis, come to Christ and no assurance and no true attainment and no true answers. Come to him tonight. Amen.